I first really ran into him in a serious way when he was director of Housing Planning Staff at the State Department, where he was Secretary Baker's director of that staff, the principal person, not only on the Arab-Israeli issue, but also on U.S.-Soviet relations and German unification issues. He was at Kent High. He stayed on in the Clinton administration as special envoy and coordinator of Middle East policy throughout the entire Clinton years, and is now director and senior professor of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's written a lot, said a lot of things. He's got a book coming out called The Missing Piece, beginning of August. And what I thought we would do this afternoon, rather than have him give another talk, is I might just ask him a question, and then you can all feel free to jump in. Dennis, do you want to go around and have
everybody or you can just have everybody answer themselves.
Let me just tell you, it's a multidisciplinary setting. Some are political scientists, some are sociologists, some are historians. One of the nice things about Michonne, we need to pull from all over the campus to be in security issues. And Dennis has been to Michonne. He's been to the third, 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 something. And you still come back. I'm tempted to ask about Iraq, but I won't. You know, in the last 3 weeks, the news plan and the withdrawal from Iran in the unilateral way. And I'm curious whether you think the time really is now to make mostly unilateral moves or to continue to try to work in a negotiated framework with the court settlement. And why?
When you do it unilaterally, it's a testament to the fact that you failed in terms of moral compliance. And I think you have to look at the last 3 years. It's interesting reality. We had a peace process through the end of the year 2000. That was, we had a peace process until January 19th.
All right.
Yes. To be fair, I think after January 2nd, 2001, we were just going through motions for all sorts of reasons, like the that we had less than 3 weeks to go. But also, Arpan had said no, and there was no ambiguity there. We preserved the fiction. He had said yes to different ideas of reservation, but it was a fiction because of the Israeli election. It wasn't because of the reality of what he had said. We knew that once we said it's over, that meant that Barack was fixed. And we thought for our public understanding, but there was no reason for us to do the PRP. There hasn't been a peace process since Bush administration. The fact is, losing perspective. I'll ask you a question. Anybody here know how many Israeli scouts? Just one of the Israeli scouts. You do the Palestinian people, just one of the Israeli scouts. Do you know how many of those had died through the first 6 months of the father when Barack was no longer the prime minister and Sharon became the prime minister? Do you have a guess? 6 months of the father.
500.
42. Anybody know how many of those have died now? 1,000. So, if you ever wanted to sort of contrast, all right, with the peace process, without the peace process, this is an interesting measure. If I were to be a Reaganologist or not, I could say, I'd be better off in Israel, I'd be better off than you were 4 years ago. I think the answer is pretty clear. You don't have a peace process, there's a terrible cost. But there's also a legacy. This is already a question. The legacy is a legacy that has produced such anger, such pain, such a deep sense of grief, such disbelief. Every time I hear somebody say, you know, the problem is there's a loss of confidence, there's a loss of trust between the Israelis and us. It's trivialized. It's not a loss of confidence, it's a loss of faith. It's not a loss of trust, it's a loss of belief. This is much more fundamental. Now, if we should recreate a negotiation, I'd be all for it. But that legacy means that fundamentally you have disbelief on your side. They don't believe they have a problem. Go through one, the reasons why each side believes they don't have a partner. Take my word for it. There is a profound sense of disbelief that anything is possible. On the Israeli side, it is deeply ingrained. I would say that there is more than 5% of the Israeli population who at this point believe that it makes sense to try to negotiate an agreement with the public. It isn't the same, by the way, that they don't, that they want a continuation of the Princeton Board.
Okay.
If you look at the polls of themselves, and they're very revealing, look at the grades you get. It isn't just that 70% of the Israeli public supports the Sharon initiative in the United States. It's that you get 75% who say give it to settlers, not just in Gaza. Give them all up. But 80% will say it'd be tougher on the public. On one hand, they want this over. And if they really believe that the Palestinians will prepare to accept them as a Jewish state and to give up terror, you find that a strong majority of Israelis, the area of two-thirds, would be supportive of something that is like what the football game is. And I say this because this is not even my assessment. I had the editor of Hatzor Faith, which is the religious settler magazine, say to me, you know, I don't want to like it, but I have to tell you, if we really knew that the Palestinians would give up terror forever and accept us as a Jewish state, then most of my constituents would have accepted the thing. And I tell you that there's hope for the future, but in the current environment, you're not going to produce hope. So would I like to see negotiations? Yes, I'd like to see negotiations. A couple months ago, I wrote an article called The Coordinated Environment. Meaning you get both sides of the discussion. You get us, the broker, which I think is still possible. I don't think you can negotiate in the future. Between them. But I also think that you have to do something. And in this mix, Sharon needs to do the unilateral idea. My problem with the unilateral idea is not that it's not a good thing to break the terror situation, but that if you don't build on it, it isn't the previous situation. So that's why I say coordinate work with the Palestinians. Work to create a way to we have got to reestablish belief. We have to end the war, reestablish the group, and only for that. Right now, since you have a unilateral initiative on the table, you have to focus on how you build on it. The administration made a big mistake. Not by doing the insurance letters to the insurance. That wasn't the big mistake. The big mistake was by not talking to the Palestinians at the same time they were doing it. They went through a 2-month process. It was public. The content wasn't, but the process was public of talking to the Israelis. But they didn't talk to the Palestinians at the same time. They didn't talk to the Europeans. They didn't talk to the Jews. Here's Sharon who says, I'm going to get out of Gaza. Who has a huge stake in what happens in Gaza? He doesn't. So you don't talk to them? Mubarak comes 2 days before Sharon, and he's told sort of the good things. And I'm reporting what the Egyptians say, so take it with a grain of salt. But their attitude was they were surprised by what came to the table. Well, I think we should have come to that. Shouldn't have waited until Mubarak shows up naked in the conversation. You have it earlier for a couple of reasons. One, it's not the Israelis who have the only responsibility. Sharon is offering something, but so what does Palestinians need to do? How are we going to make it more likely? Where do they need help? What's going to be difficult for them? How do we create a context that makes it easier for them? How do we create a context that can affect the balance of forces in one thousand? All that gives you something to work with. And that's what I would focus on. Would I like to get back to the negotiation process? Yes. At the end of the day, then we're going to solve problems. But here's an opportunity that you can act on. So that's why I live in Africa. Actually, I'll tell you, I live in Africa. We didn't ask much of that. Sharon came to the administration privately before he was announced, before he announced the policy. If I were doing what I used to do, I would have sent him a policy. Keep it to yourself, keep it private. You give it to me now. And let me go clear the package. And then we run the counseling, we run the Germans, and when we're done with the year, I would say, I'm prepared, especially with this administration, which has done almost nothing. Actually, there's a certain benefit. Now, our problem was we couldn't get the air to the war because they always knew we'd never walk away. We cared too much about it. So it was, you know, when I might threaten, but we won't walk away, and they knew we would. With Bush, they're begging for you to do something. So here was a perfect opportunity to say, you know what, I'm prepared to try to get the call. I'm prepared to produce the call, but this is what I require to do. And I would have built a package out. Sharon was giving the administration a huge amount. you could have moved your transit if you had pushed that way. But we didn't push that way. So we are where we are. And now you're going to have to create a kind of parallel. And it won't be easy. It will be harder than it was, but it's not possible. Otherwise, it's getting harder these days. Yesterday, the Israelis lost 6 soldiers. And apparently, there was a similar kind of day on the road. They have announced the number of deadly, but the numbers are probably going to be the least amount. This is part of what I'm concerned about. We can get into it. There's a big problem with the way this is being approached right now. It's not just the process, but the school is not just that they're getting into it. This is another classic example of dealing with the day after, well before the day after, and also recognizing whenever it becomes formal Israeli policy, this is what they're going to do, there's still going to be a big gap in time before they have to do it. And that gap will be filled by this. And when it's filled by this, the Israelis will look back. Violence will overwhelm the initiative. So the initiative, the end will be lost. And thus, you have to not only work with that, but you begin now to focus on what you're doing about that.
We got to work on the slide for you. I got to show you. So,
I'll call that, Jerry.
I was a better bang about that, wasn't I? You talk about a lack of trust, and I do love the way that you phrase that. Of course, there's a third party that needs to be trusted with. That's the United States. And you mentioned that the Bush administration is doing that. Can you explain why that's the case? Well, obviously, the U.S. serves this dysfunction that you just described, and why it is that they just blow it.
I think you have to understand what their assumptions were coming out. They made a basic assumption that we were too involved, we wanted too much, and frankly, if we couldn't do it, then it couldn't be done. They also looked at the regions that defined you more broadly and said, go back to what they were saying in the campaign and the coalition. And when it comes to the Middle East, you have to take a regional approach. The administration focused too much on the urban main issues. We're going to take a regional approach. We're going to deal with Iraq. We're going to deal with political power. The administration itself, the administration, didn't do enough to cement respect for the United States. That respect had to be reestablished. But the way to reestablish the respect was to show that American power meant something. There was a consequence. And then we could take on those like Saddam Hussein and show there was a consequence for those who thought that they could be affect regional bullets. So this was the kind of worldview that they came in with. Part of that, I think, was also something else. They didn't want to do issues that were too hard. And they looked at this issue and said, it's just too hard. It can't be done. Some of their assumptions, I think, were, you could have tested. I don't personally, some of what they criticized, the adult archives, they're right. The adult archives, the things I would do differently. The book comes out at the beginning of August, and I have at the end a long book at the end that's a pretty lengthy lesson chapter. And self-critical, a number of places, things we could have done differently. The problem, I think, with the administration was it operated with a false premise. The false premise was that there was nothing to be done. You couldn't make peace get where there was nothing to be done. And the task of diplomacy is oftentimes measured not only by what you achieve, but also by what you prevent. And they needed to understand that not action guaranteed that what was in the thought would be transformed into a war. When I cite 42 dead in 6 months versus nearly 1,000 in 3 years, that gives you pretty objective measure that this was transformed into something other than it was. Now, it's true, Palestinian casualties went from around 1,000 to 2,000. It's not the same order of magnitude, but it also suggested how this got transformed. they weren't thinking that way. And yet, I think what continues to be a premise to them was just too hard. They didn't get involved at all. From the very beginning of the administration, they not only said, we're not going to employ a law enforcement, it's true, I don't know how to replace it. Even they took it to lengths I didn't imagine. But they banished the word peace process. You couldn't use the word peace process in the administration. They didn't. It was in the first part of the administration. It was a conscious choice. And it was to send a message. We're not going to be like them. You know, it's true there was an ABC policy on most issues, but here there was a kind of calculated desire to prove there was a difference. By the summer, they were coming under pressure to do something. What generally isn't known is that in August, we'd like to focus on the Gulf, his good friend Trump and Zabella sent a very tough letter to the administration, basically saying, we have this relationship with you, but we're going to have to separate ourselves. You're not prepared to do something on this issue. And there was a response by the administration. The administration adopted the issue of Palestinian statehood in that letter. It was well before actually the Bush speech of the 24th of July 2022. They promised statehood, which is an interesting thing. Most people don't tend to remember this. The Clinton ideals were very far-reaching. They were basically designed to bridge the between two sides, but both sides asked them to come with a set of ideas and would offer an outcome, offer a solution. So it offered the idea of independent statehood for the Palestinians, 100% of Gaza, 95 to 97% of the West Bank. The Arab neighborhood would be producing the capital for that state. There'd be an international presence to develop for security for that state and to monitor the implementation of the agreement. There'd be a right of return for Palestinian refugees to their state, not to Israel. There'd be, in the adjustment of the borders, it was a 4 to 6% annexation to come with 80% of the settlers to Israelis. A 1 to 3% swap is a partial compensation for that annexation. So these were ideas. They were presented as ideas, and what we said at the time was, if they're not accepted, they'll be withdrawn. They'll be withdrawn. So we didn't make them policies. It was not a policy statement, although it was, once we introduced it into the reality, it was going to be part of the intellectual reality. You couldn't erase the idea that it was going to exist. But we consciously said, we consciously made a decision not to make it policy. Now, Bush made statement of the policy first quietly, policy, and then later on, he put out his speech. And the interesting thing is, in August of 2001, this was in the South, they thought this was a big deal. And he was also going to see Arafat on the margins of the UNGA, the 9/11 commitment. And so the focus became Afghanistan. And the violence kept going up, between Israelis and Palestinians. So by November, Pal gave a speech in which he said, we're going to have General Zinni go out and try to work on a ceasefire. He had a specific mandate not to get into the politics, not to get into the policy questions, only security issues. And the fact is, nothing materialized out of that. Then there was the Korean Air, which was, I call it United, this was an Iranian ship, bringing in $100 million worth of weapons. Of course, Arafat denied it. He had no responsibilities. You know, I spent more time with Arafat than any non-Palestinian. Most Palestinians will tell you more than most of them. And the one thing that is absolutely striking, I mean, you couldn't get a plane here unless Arafat signed off on it. So Shabaki, who is his money man, he's going to spend $50 million of Arafat's money, because that's the way it was always done. His money, my money. He's going to have $15 million of Arafat's money, and Arafat's not going to know that? Oh, yeah. There's a good bet on that. So, you know, the fact is, every time they would get involved a little bit, something would happen to them. It would remind them, you know, we're right. This just can't work. They do the roadmap for peace. Now, why do they do the roadmap for peace? Bush gives a speech on giving you the hope of guilt. It's not a, I'm trying to explain why they are where they are. The assumptions that they came in with, they didn't like. They get in a little bit. Then, you know, the run-up to do that war. Why is the roadmap for peace done? The roadmap for peace is done not because they believe in it. The roadmap for peace is done because they've got to bring the Arab leaders and the Europeans along enough to be supportive of what they're going to do in Iraq. So it's derivative of Iraq. But, you know, once you have something on the shelf and it becomes a policy, it can also then become something you believe in. That's what happened with Bush. To be fair to Bush, he started, you know, came under pressure from the president, we've got to do something on this issue too. So he was making calls to Arab leaders saying, you know, once we get rid of Saddam, we'll make a serious effort to get rid of Saddam. And the more he said it, the more he came to truly believe it. And I mean it seriously, not facetiously. He came to believe it. And he goes to Sharm el-Sheikh, he goes to Abu Dhabi. I was asked before what I thought about him doing that. It's a good idea. Provided it's not just going out there to make a declaration. What is going to determine what happens between the resident customers is what happens on the ground. All the good words in the world are nice, but they don't mean anything. Because the reality on the ground will overwhelm them. So if you're going to go, you're going to have the president go. He made the decision, obviously, before he asked me. You know, now I'm a commentator on Fox News, so they know I'm going to be saying something about it. So. But they, you know, so do it, but prepare the ground for it. And have somebody go out 3 weeks in advance. Don't have the president go until you've brokered a set of understandings of what each side is going to do on the ground, day by day, so you can hold them accountable for it. And either begin the process of implementation just before the president comes or have the president announce it. And then hold their feet to the fire. And be prepared to announce a daily basis or a weekly basis who's performing and who isn't. If you do that, you can take advantage of the opening. This is when Abu Mazen became prime minister. You had an opening, which you had to act on. And they didn't. The president went out, they didn't do anything. They leave John Wolfe behind, he's going to be really bad. They said, he's the John Wolfe, who's a good guy, but knows nothing about the Middle East. He's going to become the monitor. What was he supposed to monitor? You know, the roadmap to peace. You can ask because you got your watch on. Yeah, I've always said, I only had a little bit of passion for the subject. The roadmap to peace was negotiated for the reason I said it's derivative. So it's negotiated with the Russians, the EU, and the UN. Did you hear anybody who was left out? I think it's good to negotiate with the resident Palestinians. The roadmap to peace is 52 paragraphs of obligations, Israeli obligations and Palestinian obligations. There aren't too many obligations that aren't Israeli and Palestinian obligations, isn't there? But they weren't negotiated with. They were told they could comment on this, but they couldn't negotiate it. Even that might have been acceptable, but let's understand what it meant once you did this. When you negotiated among four parties who had no responsibilities for carrying it out, you didn't have any understandings at all between the Israelis and Palestinians about what these obligations meant. The Israelis define all the Palestinian obligations in the maximum way, and theirs in the minimal way. And the Palestinians define all the Israeli obligations in the maximum way, and theirs in the minimal way. So you had no understandings between the two examples that would be done. You might have been able to live with that as well. I mean, I could make the case that you could have done this and said, here's what the international community believes you need to do. But then you have to do something else. And you could even justify it, that you know what, we don't want to get into a grinding negotiation with the two sides. Because to get the two sides to come to common understanding of what they're going to do will take us the next 3 years if we're lucky. And we want to strike while the moment exists. That I could understand. But if you're going to do that, then you have to define the obligation. You've got, as I said, 52 paragraphs. Nowhere is there a definition of what we would consider to be the standard of performance. What would constitute fulfilling your obligation? And since you knew that the Israelis had one definition of their own obligation and a different one for the Palestinians, And the Palestinians have done exactly the opposite. What were you going to create? How were you going to create accountability? What were you monitoring? We didn't do that. There's no criteria for performance. And there were no understandings. And to make matters worse, which is bad enough, right? Okay, right. To make matters worse, I got out there right after the president was there. And I go out a lot, and I see everybody on his side. So I sat with Abu Mazen. And Abu Mazen says that the president has told him he doesn't have to do anything until he has got his security organization for his own. That's what he told me. He said, no, they told me. I said, Abu Mazen, the only way you can build the authority is by having the way to lift the checkpoint so you can show life is different. If nothing changes on the ground, you're not going to build your authority. And then you're not going to achieve anything. Because the Israelis are not going to lift any checkpoints until they see doing something. At least work out with them a limited set of steps. But sure enough, I went to the Israelis. And they said, no, we don't have to do it. We're not going to lift any checkpoints until he shows he's prepared to do something on security. So here was this moment. The president's out there. He has enormous leverage at that particular moment because at that point, Iraq doesn't look so bad. One. Two. You got Conference of Dela, you got President Mubarak, who feel defensive at this point. And they want to show that the association with the U.S. can mean something positive. And so all you have to do is focus on what they have to do to help Abu Mazen have. And you had to focus with Sharon on what was going to be necessary and decide, as I said before. We didn't do that. We lost the moment. At the time when I met that, when I met Abu Mazen, I said, right, you say you need time to put together your securitization. But how much time do you have before you have to deliver it? Before Arafat approaches, because he knew Arafat would be secure. Because I said at the time publicly, Arafat had to have Abu Mazen there. Because if Abu Mazen succeeded, it would have proven that Arafat was the problem. Because there was no way that he could let Abu Mazen succeed. But it didn't mean that he could necessarily succeed in blocking. If you created the right kind of help in the air from Israel and from us. Now, here again, the administration has an image that it did a lot at that moment. But it didn't. So it tends to confirm the assumption that every time you try something, it doesn't work out. So you started with the presumption that it's too hard. And then every time you've made an effort, they see it as having been significant, I see it as having been minimal. But it's convinced them that it's too hard. Now, they're making another low-key effort now. I hope that it will become something more significant, but
And John, you look at the numbers from the Science Department. This probably wouldn't help sales of your book, but one possibility is to take a push policy with logical conclusions and simply give up. The situation, the way you said, is basically hopeful short on McDonald's a little later. I mean, you've now lived through 9,486 surefire plans to solve this situation. Your book will have another one. I'm not looking forward to that. If it's a problem of people dying, we could actually make a difference if I fix it in Congo and really stop people from being killed. And so the issue would be, why don't we just forget about it? And if the two sides get their act together and stop being thrown around by their own, duped around by their own extremists, maybe something could happen, but until then,
well, in a sense, I think that was the Bush strategy.
And the Bush strategy was wait until it didn't sound like it.
Right. In a sense, I mean, they never admitted it, but I think the strategy was it's too hard to do. When they're finally exhausted, that'll be the time to do something.
Maybe the 27th century.
Well, that is the problem. The problem is that you see what's happened in the last 2+ years. It's gotten a hell of a lot worse. The whole thing done is a hell of a lot deeper.
It's not as bad as Sudan and Congo.
It's not as bad as Sudan and Congo, but look what it does. Capturing international attention.
What's
not
paying attention?
Bush isn't paying attention. They're not creating attention. It captures attention for a whole set of other reasons. If we got a problem in the Islamic world, if this were diffused, if we at least made the effort to show that we're doing something and that we care about it, would everything become perfectly fine? No, absolutely not. If the conflict ended tomorrow, would we not have a problem with the Muslim world? We still have problems.
Norway doesn't have problems in most of the world, and that's because it doesn't do it.
Yeah, the difference is we're seen as the one country that can do something and we don't. We're seen as the one country that has the power to affect things and we don't. We have to at least show that we care. This is an issue. In the war on terror, what is the major problem that I think that we have? The major problem we have is we can kill every Hamas operative. But if you've got an environment that creates anger and hostility and alienation and frustration, you've got a ready pool of new recruits. Every Arab regime that is, in fact, I would say, rather oppressive, including among our friends, everyone uses this issue. They may become trapped by it, but they use this issue. And they use this issue to play up on the anger, to divert the attention away from their own failures. Now, one of the things we have to do, at a minimum, is at least show that we're prepared to try to do something like that in a serious way. Not because it's going to be a panacea, but at least because it might reduce the recruiting pool that exists today for hate in America.
You don't think it increases the recruiting pool now?
No, it's the opposite.
Zionist Crusader Alliance sort of thing, that argument was made.
But it's interesting that when we had an active peace process, the care didn't go away, but we weren't hated the same. I agree with you. I'm not talking about worldwide. I'm talking about in the Middle East. I'm talking about in the Islamic world. I want to find ways to refuse the sources of anger and hostility towards us. I want to, not just towards us, but also in the region as a whole. This is an issue that has a kind of enduring sense of grievance. It's a wrong that has to be right. An injustice that hasn't been dealt with. The Arab satellite networks show the worst possible images of Israeli brutality possible. But at the end of the case, so it feeds the anger. We got to contend with that. One way to contend with it is to try, in fact, to stop the war. I don't think we can make peace right now. But I know we can't make peace until we stop the war. So I think it's worth the effort. I suspect whoever is president from next year would make more efforts, even in the Bush administration, because I think the lineup's going to be different. Now, will they make the kind of effort I would make? Probably not. But I would make the effort, not because I think we're going to have such a wonderful answer, but because I think it's necessary to demonstrate that we do care about it. And I think the image in the Middle East today is we don't care about it. Even in Israel, it's very interesting. I go there a lot. We care for us too. But what's interesting is when you talk to those Israelis right now, it's quite interesting to hear their view of the Bush administration. Sharon says the Bush administration is the best friend he has ever had. But if you talk to those Israelis, they don't feel that way. Because they see it kind of disengaging. So in a strange, paradoxical way, the one thing that Arabs and Israelis may agree upon is that the U.S. should be engaged in Israel.
In terms of addressing the issue of our representing American policy in the Middle East, wouldn't it be, and it might be fantastic, but wouldn't it be possible at least once to actually have the United States publicly and flagrantly prevent Israel from doing something that it wants to do? Or punishing them by actually reducing aid significantly, or not selling them weapons, or not giving them weapons, or publicly excoriating their leadership for policies that they don't like, so Arabs can look and say, God, you know, the United States actually has changed and become far more critical of their Zionist crusader ally. Is not Arabs looking for? Aren't they looking for like a little sign or signal for the United States that that Israel has some limits, that Israel is just making American foreign policy in the Middle East?
Yeah, I think they are. But I would also, again, being a veteran of this stuff, I can tell you that as soon as you do it the first time, it satisfies the Arabs for about 2 weeks. And then they say, what have you done for me lately? But one of the things that has to change, everybody has to change. The Israelis have to change. Israelis do have to adjust to the reality. They have to find a way to get up control of that. They do. Palestinians and Arabs have to adjust to the reality. They actually have to assume responsibility. They actually do have to do something. The Arab world is great for crying crocodile tears about the Palestinian cause. And I'm dealing with, I'm when I talk about, I want to refuse the issue, I'm talking about not air believers, I'm talking about public voters altogether. We do have to prove to them that at least we can do something to care about. And it certainly, there are public cautions we can have that are a little different than the ones we have now, that can make some difference. But we shouldn't have any illusions about it. Arab leaders continue to find this conflict convenient. They continue to use it as their excuse to say publicly, how can we reform when we have this? As if, and explain to what the relationship is. You know, that corruption is a good thing for you. You can't have a rule of law. These are all because of the Palestinians. The fact is, the issue of responsibility in the Arab world is one that is something that is rarely embraced. And Palestinians are much the same way. One of Yasser Arafat's enduring legacies is that he made being a victim not just a condition, but a strategy. And when you're a victim, it's not up to you. You're never responsible, you're never accountable. You wait for somebody else. So, you know, merely saying something differently, or punishing the Israelis at a certain point, you know, it doesn't transform that world. It can be useful as part of an overall strategy.
Has that ever been done?
Sure.
Give you an example of where Israel paid a price for engaging in a policy because of that.
Yeah, well, when Israel bombed the fleet,